Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the proposition that we may only have 1 year left to save American democracy from an autocratic president who is increasingly isolated from reality as he and his tightening inner circle of right-wing zealots move to undo institutions and confront the truth in a fascistic approach to governance that indicates a fascist worldview. Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale, who has researched and written extensively on Hitler and Stalin, joins us to discuss his latest book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, and how, as the incompetence and crudeness of the Trump administration drives down the popularity of the Republicans heading into the 2018 elections, Trump will try to stage a coup to overthrow American democracy. We will assess the extent to which American institutions already under attack from the Trump administration, like the judiciary, the military, the intelligence community, the press, and now much of corporate America, as well as an expanding majority of the American people, will fight back against Donald Trump's incipient authoritarian regime. Then we will speak with Thomas Wright, a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. He joins us to discuss his latest book, All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power, and explore the reasons why Trump is undermining America's longstanding alliances while ceding global leadership to China on trade, the environment, and now human rights. Then finally, with the Supreme Court taking up a cell phone tracking case that will test the boundaries between technology and privacy, we'll examine the issues surrounding CSLI, cell site location information, with Mark Rotenberg, the president and executive director of EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He joins us to discuss how the current third-party doctrine, which the government relies on to justify warrantless tracking and surveillance, needs to be updated in the digital age, as smartphones can now provide precise location information on citizens similar to GPS tracking devices, which in 2012 the Supreme Court ruled against allowing the police to place on vehicles on Fourth Amendment grounds. And joining us now is Timothy Snyder, who's a professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, the History of Nazi and Soviet Mass Killings on the Lands Between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a book of the year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. Most recently, he helped Tony Judd to compose a thematic history of political ideas and intellectuals in politics, Thinking the 20th Century. And his latest book just out is On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Snyder.
Glad to be speaking to you.
And obviously, the word fascist is thrown around often and irresponsibly, particularly on the left, but more and more, it's seeming to be applicable in terms of Donald Trump. In many ways, there's also another aspect with Donald Trump, and that is we have probably not had a leader of this country till you'd have to go back to the madness of King George, in effect, where the courtiers around him pretended he wasn't crazy. And that seems to be what's happening here in the United States, that we have a president who is clearly exhibiting mental problems, frankly. And those around him, the few adults in the room, are being undercut constantly. And in the case of Mattis, McMaster, and Gary Cohn and Tillerson, they're basically being marginalized, and we don't know how long that they can make excuses for this guy and defend the indefensible. And if they go, then we have more Stephen Bannons and Stephen Millers. So to my mind, this is an extremely bleak situation.
Well, I'm hardly going to disagree with you there. Let me try to parse out some of the 3 points that I think you're making. On the fascism, it's one problem that Americans have is that we want to choose. We want to say, you know, yes, it's Hitler, no, it's Hitler. And if it's not exactly like Hitler, then we're going to ignore all the history. I think it's much more useful to look at fascism as a phenomenon and to remember the things that were characteristic of it. One of them was the specific use of language, particularly the attempt to transform discourse in such a way that there were clear insiders and outsiders, people who belonged to the people and other people who didn't. A second characteristic of fascism was the attempt to put a face on globalization rather than saying, look, we face certain objective problems. Instead, to say it's a conspiracy. Usually for the fascists, it was a conspiracy of Jews, but it can be another conspiracy. And a third element of fascism was the dependence on the threat of terrorism, anticipation or the exploitation of real terrorist actions to try to consolidate power. It wouldn't exhaust the Trump phenomenon to say that he's a fascist, but I think it does make a lot of sense to attend to these parts of fascism. On the point about the instability, I mean, I would see that a slightly different way. I don't feel close enough to the person to want to diagnose. But to everyone who's not sure whether this is fascism or authoritarianism or populism or what sort of ism it is, I mean, I would offer a simpler image, and that is of a man who clearly does not feel obliged by or constrained by the rule of law, by the system that we have, and who will constantly push and push and push and push against those constraints until he finds some kind of a weakness. In other words, he's not going to change. Whatever he is, he's not going to change. What can change is the system, which means that we all have to be on our guard in trying to protect the system. As to the courtiers, I mean, I'm going to offer again a slightly different observation. I don't feel qualified to do the Sovietology of who is actually in and who is actually out, but if you want to predict a Trump foreign policy move, I think it makes less sense to ask about Bannon and McMaster and so on. And if you really want to game it, you know, to ask really what would Putin do? Because in all of the last, you know, no matter where it comes from, I'm not saying I know, but in all of these moves, whether it's talking about the EU, whether it's talking about NATO, whether it's talking about climate, or whether it's talking about terrorism, what one finds is that if there's a choice, Trump ends up doing the thing which is more like what the Russians do or what they would like for him to do.
So you don't think that there's an element here of everything has been about the black guy that preceded him? He gets blamed for everything. Trump started the whole calumny about Obama being a Kenyan and anti-colonial with no valid passport, etc. And everything that he's done so far has been to undo any signature agreement of Obama's. Now he's going to go off to Cuba. So it seems like in many ways he's sort of defined by undoing what the other guy did, and that is in many ways a reflection of the direction the Republican Party has taken. It's no longer a party that offers solutions in this traditional conservative sense. It's basically a party that just reacts that whatever the liberals did, we're going to undo.
I think there are all kinds of impulses within the Republican Party and within the White House for that matter, and what you're describing is a kind of lowest common denominator, and it's one that's rather sad, because after all, wouldn't the natural thing be to propose policies to the American people which would give them some increase in welfare or some increase in security or opportunity? None of the policies which are being proposed now, either from the White House or from Congress, meet that basic standard. Instead, as you say, it seems to be the kind of emotional resentment, which, you know, amounts to if we can't do it, then they can't do it either. So if the Trump presidency is not going to have legislation, then what we'll do is we'll undo the legislation of the previous administration. And if it is racially coded, if you're right about that, it's certainly racially coded in a depressing way, because what it amounts to is a white president saying, well, I can't do as well as a black president, so what I'm going to do is to try to undo the achievements of the black president. And if that's where we are as a country, then it's a very sad place indeed.
And again, I'm speaking with Timothy Snyder, who's a professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, A History of Nazi and Soviet Mass Killings on the Lands Between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a Book of the Year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in four countries. Most recently, he helped Tony Judd to compose a thematic history of political ideas and intellectuals in politics, Thinking the 20th Century. And his latest book just out is On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. I don't know whether you caught the op-ed by Marcia Gessen in Sunday's New York Times, but she's one of the few people that's actually interviewed Putin. She's a Russian-American journalist who did a very powerful book on Putin, The Man Without a Face. the point that she made was, and I suppose in many ways Bertolt Brecht made that same point in the resistible rise of Arturo Uy, where history is often judged by the numbers of bodies that tyrants pile up and the lands that they conquer, but not focusing on who they were as individuals. And in both the case of Stalin and Hitler, they're very small, insecure, ill-educated, bitter, and rather horrible people. And frankly, I see Donald Trump in that light as a human being. I don't see there's very much redeeming about him.
Well, I try to avoid the danger of falling into the personal judgments, not because I disagree with you, but because I feel like we can believe that if we judge the person correctly, then that we've somehow judged the politics correctly. And as we know, it's the case that people who might have few redeeming personal features, such as Hitler and Stalin, can make an awfully big difference in the course of events. I guess with Mr. Trump, I would stress something a little bit more sociological, which is a little bit reminiscent of Hitler, which is the phenomenon of the loser as winner. I think the charisma of Mr. Trump resides in the fact that he is both a loser and a winner at the same time. He's not really a success in life, but the success that he has consists in telling other people that he is a success and getting other people to believe it. Hitler was a bit like that as well. I mean, the whole narrative of Mein Kampf, if you forget for a minute, the conspiracy theory and the anti-Semitism and the racism, is about how someone who is basically a loser is in the end going to triumph all the same. So that's a part of the appeal of Mr. Trump, I think, is that he is the loser's winner or the winner's loser. He gives people the sense that even if their own lives don't seem to be going well, there's some kind of a shortcut that the little man, as people said in Hitler's time, the little man will somehow jump forward and somehow succeed on Mr. Trump's coattails. I think that's the image, and one doesn't have to like that and to appreciate that it does have a certain kind of political power. Of course, once he becomes leader, then he can't lead in a normal way because he's not actually a success. He's never actually managed anything, and so on.
Well, but the analogies that are pretty clear are in terms of what he is undoing and undoing institutions, as Bannon has said. He wants to deconstruct the regulatory state, and he was elected by denigrating expertise and by suggesting that all that those preceded him are incompetents, losers, and he is a winner. So those seem to be following the footsteps particularly of a tyrant like Hitler. But I guess the question that we're stuck with here is, what is the Reichstag fire and when does it happen? My sense is that we are hanging by a thread if you look at what just happened in London, which of course Donald Trump is insulting the mayor of London, misconstruing what he's said. And basically he's been saying every time there's a terrorist attack, I told you so, I told you so. Can you speculate for a moment, Timothy Snyder, of what would happen here in the United States if there were an ISIS-type terrorist attack? Would that not play into the hands of the possibility that it could be turned into a kind of Reichstag fire?
So, I mean, I warn about that in On Tyranny. It's lesson 17, 18, 19, and 20 in On Tyranny. Beware of dangerous language. Be calm when the unthinkable arrives, and so on. So it's historically the case that terrorism is a kind of politics, and what terrorists dream about is a leader like Mr. Trump. There's a pretty close circuit between the leader who needs the terrorist threat because he doesn't really have policy, but he wants an excuse to change the system, and the terrorist who needs the authoritarian leader to clamp down and alienate populations in order to improve the terrorist recruitment. That's a circuit, the circuit between terrorism and right-wing politics that we've seen for a whole century of European history and that we see now around the world. And so even before we get to the Reichstag fire, what I want to say is that it's important for us to recognize that there's a politics of this. Mr. Trump is in a very comfortable situation, I think personally and politically, when there's a terrorist attack in another country, because he doesn't have to be responsible for it himself, but he can say, oh yes, I was right about all of this. And when he talks about terrorism in London and criticizes the mayor in London, what he's doing, aside from being unspeakably inhuman about the whole situation, is that He's blocking out any attempt to talk about policy, to talk about reform, to talk about health care, to talk about anything meaningful in the United States. Instead, we all have to fixate on terrorism. Now, the Reichstag fire is an extreme example of this. Every aspirant to modern tyranny from Hitler forward understands the link between the fear of terrorism and the reality of terrorism and regime change. The Reichstag fire itself was an act of terrorism inside Germany, which Hitler exploited to transform what was still a republic into what became the fearsome Nazi regime. Variants of this have popped up all over the place since then, perhaps most notably in Russia in 1999, which is why it's so striking that Mr. Trump keeps admiring the Russian approach to terrorism. The Russian approach to terrorism, of course, is to exploit it to change the regime from within. So, you know, what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, I'm not going to speculate, because that's beyond our control, and I think perhaps completely unpredictable. But what is within our control is how we react. It is pretty likely that there's going to be some kind of incident in the United States, given that the Trump presidency is exacerbating internal American tensions, and most American terrorism historically comes from America. But the Trump presidency is alienating Muslims, thereby making Muslim terrorism, unfortunately, more likely. And so wherever it comes from, whether it's real, whether we're not sure, certain that it's real, even if it's fabricated, which is, of course, always possible, some governments do that, wherever it comes from, we have to, when the next terrorist attack comes, despite our emotions, despite our fear and our grief, realize that our first priority has to be to defend our rights. If we let the rights slip away, if we accept some kind of emergency decree, it will become very hard to get those rights back. So rather than, you know, getting too frightened about scenario A, B, or C, I think we just have to recognize something like this could happen. And when it does happen, the easy thing to do is to give up your rights. But that's something you're going to regret later on. We have to be calm when the unthinkable arrives, precisely. We have to prepare ourselves for it. And when it comes, what we have to be demonstrating, what we have to be demonstrating for will be for our rights. And I think if we think about this in advance, it's not going to work.
And you were referring in the Russian context to the bombing of the apartment buildings on the outskirts of Moscow that led to the rise of Putin. And there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that he staged, or the intelligence services staged those bombings in order for him to prosecute the Chechen war and to become, in effect, the dictator that he has become. So if Trump is following Putin's playbook, there is a roadmap there. But on the other hand, you've been quoted, Timothy Snyder, as saying it's pretty much inevitable that Trump will try to stage a coup and overthrow our democracy. And that what concerns you is that because of his, what I've described as mental instability, which, of course, under the Goldwater rule, you can't make those kind of diagnoses without actually treating the patriot. So I'm just taking my own observations of his behavior as evidence that this is somebody that's not particularly normal or stable, at least in the terms that we've become used to. But that this continuing chaos, and which is a result, I think, of rampant incompetence, and the advice of people like Bannon and Miller and company, who are basically ideologues, and the professionals are getting marginalized, like the generals. And it's pretty odd to be in a situation where you're depending upon generals to save you, but that's the situation we have, it seems. But just this is a long-winded way to suggest that by the midterm elections in 2018, the Republicans might be in trouble. And is that your sense, that that could be a period of danger to watch?
It's something that I think we don't want to sleepwalk into, including if we're Republicans or Republican elected representatives, because you can get tempted into things without ever thinking them through, or without ever quite realizing where the logic of events is taking you. So if you look at 2018, yeah, there are three issues, two of which you've already named. The first is we have a president with marked authoritarian tendencies, who openly admires a whole number of foreign dictators who have used terrorism or the threat of terrorism to rise to power, consolidate power. Secondly, we're in an odd structural situation where the minority party, that is the smaller party, the Republicans, hold all the levels of power but they don't actually have popular policies. So it's, I mean, maybe they'll, you know, maybe they'll surprise me and come up with a whole bunch of things. But right now, the stuff they're offering, that is taking health care away from 25 million people and giving tax cuts to the rich, it's not popular even among their own base. So that, you know, that situation where you're, and then the third problem is the structural American problem, that our democracy is very flawed. And the reason why we have the Republican majority in the House and the reason why we have Mr. Trump as president have to do with gerrymandering and the Electoral College. I mean, those people won lots of votes. I don't mean to deny that. But on an even playing field, we wouldn't have that Republican majority and Mr. Trump wouldn't be president. So it's precisely the undemocratic parts of the American system which, you know, tilt things in a certain direction. So if you're in the situation, you know, unstable executive, no popular policies, and you owe your own power to the undemocratic parts of the system, the temptation might well be there to make the system just a little bit more undemocratic rather than having to face up to the fact that the stuff you're doing is not very popular. So I think 2018 is something to be very alert about, especially for Republicans. This would be a good moment for Republicans to, you know, to try to be normal about elections, try to come up with policies, you know, win fair and square, because the way things are going, they're creating a moral hazard for themselves. And it's also a good moment for Democrats to announce early that they're running for office, local office, state office, whatever office. Make sure that the notion of 2018 elections is normalized. The thing to watch out for is not exactly a coup. That's not what I said. I said they'll try something. It's very likely they'll try something. The situation to watch out for is that we will have elections in 2018, but they will be under the shadow of some surprising event, or under the shadow of some kind of emergency rule. That's what I'm worried about, and I think that's what people, you know, of good faith, of patriotic convictions, of constitutional convictions on both sides of the political divide should make sure does not happen.
Well, just in closing, because one doesn't want to reinforce despair and not enough people are politically active and not enough people vote. So rather than paralyze people, and I think it's surely we are the majority. This is the tyranny of the minority. And it would seem to me that already there are indications of blowback from Trump's misrule. I think the judiciary, even the conservatives in the judiciary, are deeply insulted by his attacks on them. The intelligence community are definitely insulted. These are people that aren't paid well, and they're only purpose in life is to feel a part of a kind of patriotic mission. And when they're told that they're a bunch of Nazis and incompetents, that really attacks their honor, which is one of the few things that they have. I think he's really picked some serious fights. So is there a way, do you think, rather than depend, I mean, it's an odd landscape to be in where conservatives who used to be red baiters and Soviet haters are now making excuses for Putin, and liberals who used to be afraid of the CIA are now hoping that the CIA finds the evidence to impeach Trump. So it's a strange landscape, but within this landscape, what can the average person do who is concerned for the future of the republic?
An awful lot. An awful lot. I mean, we can look and muse at the odd situation where we're depending on, you know, we're depending on the spies to save us from the generals. We're depending on the generals to save us from the kleptocrats, and we're depending on the kleptocrats to save us from the fascists. We can muse upon that. It's unfortunately very much close to reality, but we don't have to depend upon that. The interesting thing about moments of attempted regime change is that the citizen actually has more power rather than less. In a democracy, you have a certain amount of power. If the authoritarian regime change takes place, you have much, much less power. But in that transitional moment where we are now, you have more because you have the ability to take actions which will make that regime change much less likely. History gives us a sense of how things can go wrong and just how wrong they can go. But it also, and this is the main subject of On Tyranny, it's the point of On Tyranny, it also gives us the wisdom of people who have faced these kinds of threats or much more challenging ones before us and who have generously left behind a record. So the answer is we can do an awful lot. Just not drifting is doing a lot. Picking an institution and defending it will help enormously. Managing one's everyday contacts with other people so that there are more of them, they're more in public. These little things can make a tremendous amount of difference. So it would be Pollyannish to say, oh, this is just an opportunity to show how great American democracy is. American democracy is under threat. But it is an opportunity for American citizens to realize themselves as citizens and to do the kinds of things that they will be proud of in a year or 5 years or 10 years. That there is that opportunity now. People really can make a difference.
Well, Timothy Snyder, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Timothy Snyder, who's a professor of history at Yale. In 2010, he published Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, a history of Nazi and Soviet mass killings on the lands between Berlin and Moscow. It was named a Book of the Year by some dozen publications and was a bestseller in 4 countries. Most recently, he helped Tony Judd to compose a thematic history of political ideas and intellectuals in politics, Thinking the 20th Century. And his latest book, just out, is On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. We can take a brief station break and be back exploring the reasons why Trump is undermining America's longstanding alliances while ceding global leadership to China on trade, the environment, and now human rights.
I'm looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the South is yours.
Rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Thomas Wright, a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Wright.
Thank you.
And Thomas, I'm going to give you the unenviable task of telling our listeners why Donald Trump is undermining America's longstanding alliances while ceding global leadership to China on trade, the environment, and now we learn human rights.
Yes, but I think what we're seeing very dramatically over the last few weeks really is the coming to fruition of his America First worldview. I mean, President Trump does view the world very narrowly, sees America's interests and role in it in very sort of narrow ways, that he thinks that the U.S. only has really a transactional relationship with key allies, and that there's nothing more broader to do with a common sense of what the world should look like or what international order should be, or that they're based on the sense of common values. He really looks at it and says, what's Germany giving me this week or this month? You know, what am I getting out of this relationship with Japan right at this particular moment? And so he's, I think, adopting a much more transactional and sort of self-interested point of view. And the upshot of all of that is that these alliances are being very badly damaged, and that he's trying to sort of pull back. He doesn't want to express support for traditional commitments like with NATO. And then he's making other decisions like today on the Middle East pretty much on the fly on Twitter. And so I think it's something that's very alarming to America's friends around the world. And really it appears to be sort of unsustainable that this, if this continues, the repercussions could be quite severe.
But there's also a schizophrenia and a confusion within his own administration. You've got the so-called adults that people are counting on to bring some stability to this regime, the generals Mattis and McMaster, to some extent Tillerson and Gary Cohn. it's increasingly apparent that Trump is turning more to the white nationalists, Bannon and Stephen Miller, none of whom have any international military intelligence or any other experience that we can point to. So is this basically, I mean, I guess this is a thin reed, isn't it, that we're depending on here, that the few adults in the room, even if Trump himself is not in the same room, somehow can restrain his impulses, whether they're tweeting or reaching for the nuclear button.
Yeah, I do think the adults in the room exercise some constraints on the president, but not as typically sort of thought. So one effect of having Mattis, McMaster, Kelly Tillerson and others in the positions that they're in is they restrict the options that are available to the president. I mean, they essentially, if they don't control the bureaucracy, they certainly have a blocking stake in it. And so it's very hard for President Trump to actually proactively, you know, implement a major policy, like imagine a new Yalta agreement with Russia. That would be impossible to get through, I think, with his cabinet the way it is. So I think they do have a constraining influence there. But that's not the same thing as being able to make Trump do whatever they want. And so I've always said that what we ought to be worried about the most is not what Trump will proactively do to remake the world, but the things that he will refuse to do. So he may refuse to uphold an alliance, or he may just refuse to be proactive on something that America's traditionally played a crucial role in. And I think that's what's playing out here. You know, he just didn't want to say the words about Article 5 at the NATO summit, so he just didn't do it. And the fact that Mattis, McMaster and others wanted him to wasn't enough. So I think we're seeing this sort of, you know, this two-pronged sort of approach where both of these forces, like the president and his America First view, and then the adults in the room with their more mainstream view, both of those matter, but they won't win out. No one side will win all the time. Each of them will win some of the time. And so happened at the NATO summit, or when the president is crucial to a decision, he'll often win out, whereas on a day-to-day basis, the bureaucracy and the mainstream elements will tend to predominate.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ryder, fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. Well, not only were Mattis, McMaster and Tillerson blindsided by the fact that they thought the speech where Donald Trump at NATO headquarters is standing right in front of the twisted metal from the Twin Towers, where he was supposed to invoke support for Article 5, and to their surprise, he didn't, because Bannon and Stephen Miller, apparently, along with Trump, took it out of the speech. Now, a very important audience for that speech, surely, is Vladimir Putin. And so what does that send to him? What message does it send to Putin, and particularly the Baltic states, who are very concerned about whether America would invoke Article 5 in their defense if Putin were to send in the little green man in this unconventional warfare that he's perfected? So that, to me, is really, isn't that where the rubber meets the road? If Trump is the commander-in-chief, and the commander-in-chief is signaling to America's mischievous enemy, Vladimir Putin, that he's got a green light. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at the history of deterrence and sort of the U.S. Position in Europe, it all really rests on this promise that the U.S. will defend European countries as if they are America, right? That during the Cold War, the U.S. was willing to trade New York for Paris, as it was called. The idea was that if the Russians and Soviets invaded Western Europe, that the U.S. would go to war, even though that would put the American homeland at risk. And even though that, you know, doesn't make a massive amount of rational sense, because obviously the United States will care more about its own territory than somebody else's, it did make a lot of strategic sense, because that threat or that promise was enough to keep the peace in the Cold War by removing any ambiguity. And removal of ambiguity is really the sort of the cornerstone of American strategy. It's saying, with all of these 29 countries now that are in NATO, you know, that they will all be protected, and that's a red line. If it's crossed, there'll be pretty much an automatic response. And that's sort of the promise that American presidents have made, even though the original NATO treaty is a little bit more ambiguous than that. what President Trump has done is essentially to remove that uncertainty and to create ambiguity. And we know from history that wars often start when the situation is relatively ambiguous, when one country thinks that it can make a big gain and then miscalculates. I mean, if you look at, you know, the wars that the U.S. has been involved in since World War II, quite a few of them, you know, a couple, two or three, have been pretty serious, have started because of this. The Korean War denounced and ruled South Korea outside of the U.S. perimeter of defense, and then North Korea invaded in the Kuwait war to liberate Kuwait. The U.S. ambassador told Saddam Hussein that the U.S. may not be that interested in its dispute with Kuwait, and then Saddam invaded. And so this, I think, is very, very dangerous. We don't know how Putin will respond. We hope that he won't sort of be very risk-acceptant and try to push the envelope in Eastern Europe, but it's impossible to know. And I think this is just a very dangerous and very irresponsible, you know, position that the president is taking.
And, of course, Vice President Pence on Monday went to NATO headquarters to try and reassure NATO, quoting Pence, "Make no mistake, our commitment is unwavering. We will meet our obligations to our people to provide for the collective defense of all of our allies. An attack on one is an attack on all of us." But let's try and figure out then, and I may this may again be this is asking too much, I certainly can't figure this out, and maybe we'll get a little more clarity on Thursday from the former FBI director. But what do you think is going on with this Trump-Russia mystery? I understand that he's had business ties with Russian oligarchs, and they bailed him out after the Wall Street banks blackballed him. So I can understand the money ties, and maybe the guy's naive and thinks, well, you know, I had great money deals with these guys, so we can just translate that into political deals. But in terms of the ideology, if there's an ideological connection, that seems to come from Bannon, as far as I can tell, because Vladimir Putin, like Bannon, is a white nationalist who is hostile to multiculturalism and gay and lesbian rights, and the idea of diluting the white race in Russia in many ways is the last bastion of whiteness. And, of course, the other overriding prejudice, or whatever you want to call it, they have, or worldview that they have, is this fear of Islam. So is that a fair assessment? I mean, I think the money side's clearer, but I'm trying to figure out what the ideological connection is, if indeed there is one.
Yeah, you know, Trump has had a weird relationship with Russia for a very long time, back really to the mid-1980s. In the early 80s, he saw himself as a negotiator for the U.S. in arms control agreements with the Soviets. And he actually lobbied to get on the team, even though he had really no experience whatsoever. He visited Russia in the 80s, came back quite impressed. He went again in 1990, came back disillusioned that they hadn't put down the revolution in the same way that the Chinese had. He went several times, I think, over the years, and really there was never any, you know, so he's someone who, you know, knows Russia a little bit. I mean, he hasn't, you know, spent a lot of time overseas, but he's certainly been in Russia several times. And, you know, I think there's lots of conspiracy theories out there, and there's lots of things that will be investigated and should be investigated. But the best I can do in terms of a rational explanation is that if you look at his history, he's generally upset at countries that the U.S. has an economic relationship with. Like, he's generally upset with Japan in the 80s or China today. But the U.S. has almost no relationship economically with Russia. So he's no real problem there. He's never really cared about Europe, so he doesn't really worry about the Russian threat to Europe. And as he looks at the threats that he does see from a rising China economically, and, you know, is a political Islam, he sees Russia as an ally against both of those. And then I think he just likes authoritarians, so he does like Putin as a person and as a leader. And I think that's the best I can do as sort of a rational case. I actually think Trump is arguably more pro-Russian than Bannon is, because Bannon, I think, has, you know, gravitated a little bit toward Russia, but more out of necessity because of his concerns about and the way he views radical Islam or political Islam. He's come around to Russia for that reason. But for Trump, it actually predates that, and it's more deeply rooted. Now, there may be other things there. We just don't know. But we do know that he has sort of been pretty favorable to them for quite some time.
So what do you think is happening in Europe with these elections in September in Germany? It seems like all the candidates, Merkel and the Social Democrats, are running against Trump. And it looks like Theresa May is in trouble, even though she called this election and had a pretty commanding lead, I think largely because she's too tied to Trump. I mean, his gratuitous spat with the mayor of London. By the way, I think one of the things that's not being adequately reported there, and I'm not trying to defend Donald Trump's outrageous behavior, but when Trump tweeted that the mayor of London wasn't alarmed, you know, I think he said 7 people killed and all that terrorist attack, and the mayor of London is not alarmed. I think that was based upon the fact that he was watching Fox News, and it was Fox News that edited out the context of the mayor of London's remarks. So again,
that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, that's this is the Pravda of the Republican Party we're talking about here. You know, so it's pretty disgusting.
Yeah.
But just in terms of, is being tied to Trump now a liability for our allies as much as he is himself seems to be undermining the alliances themselves?
Yeah, I do think it definitely is a problem. I think there's a couple of things on that, though. One is on the criticism of the London mayor. I mean, this is really odd to me because he, you know, it's just a brilliant example of Trump's self-destructiveness, because Cannes said something critical of Trump a year ago. So it wasn't recently at all. He criticized him back when Trump was a candidate and said something about London, and Cannes criticized him at that time. He's never criticized him, as far as I know, as president. And so for Trump to sort of react to this attack by resurrecting a, 10-month-old spat with the mayor of London and then sticking to it is just extraordinary. You know, it's not as if Cam was on TV criticizing Trump that morning. So I just thought that was really, maybe not all that surprising anymore, but was very unfortunate. May, I've been really stunned by the British election. I still think she'll win. I still think she'll get a majority. But it's been much closer than she would like. Corbyn's done much better than people have expected. He is, I think, totally unprepared really to govern. It will be very, very difficult for him if he won. He's benefiting, I think, a bit from the Trump effect, but I think there are deeper things going on that remind us that there's still this very anti-establishment movement, whether it's on the left or on the right in Britain and in Europe as a whole, and that has not gone away.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Thomas Wright. And of course, I just will add that the very conservative Wall Street Journal editorial board have an editorial today basically saying that Trump is his own worst enemy. But thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. And his latest book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Supreme Court taking up a cell phone tracking case that will test the boundaries between technology and privacy.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual friend.
Let me cruise through the city. I can make it, put your phone down. You ain't gonna text no one when you're with me. I can make it, put your phone down, so you can show me attention. And I'll cut mine off too. Boy, that I have when I listen, I can make it, put your phone down. Baby, we don't need it. Every time you get a message, act like you don't see it. I can make it, put your phone down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Rodenberg, who's the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University and has frequently testified before Congress and has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD and legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO. And he chairs the American Bar Association's Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Mark. And the Supreme Court has just taken up a case called Carpenter. And this case involves a man convicted of armed robberies in Michigan and Ohio, where police accessed 127 days of his cell phone records, revealing 12,898 points of location data. And that, of course, went to an appeals court. It lost in a 2-1 decision. The defendant lost, and now it is before the Supreme Court. And I take it that what's at stake here, or what's the foundation, if you will, in terms of the law, is what's called third-party doctrine. So would you explain that to us, if you don't mind?
Sure. So as a general matter, the Fourth Amendment restricts the ability of the government to conduct searches absent the issuance of a warrant or probable cause. The presumption, of course, is that the search is being directed toward the home or offices of the person who's the target. But when the search is directed to a third party who may be in possession of the business records or activities of the target, a case in the in the 1970s, concluded that there was no Fourth Amendment basis on which to challenge the search of the so-called third party. And so what arose was a bit of a vacuum in Fourth Amendment protections for personal information when that data was held by a bank or was held by a telephone company or was held by a private business. As a practical matter, Congress has, through the enactment of statutes, created many privacy safeguards for companies that are in possession of the data of their customers and clients, and this is true now for banks and telephone companies, even though the Constitution doesn't establish the protection. Public laws, such as the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, for example, do. But legal scholars have felt for many years that there's incoherence here, and of course, if we have a constitutional right to protect our information, in a sense, it shouldn't be abandoned once that information is held by others. So the court is now given the opportunity in this case to reconsider this question as to whether constitutional protections should extend to third parties. And we know from some of the recent opinions from the court, including a stirring concurrence by Justice Sotomayor in an opinion a couple of years ago in the GPS tracking case, Jones versus the United States, that there may well be support to revisit this doctrine.
Well, clearly, this third-party doctrine is inadequate, wouldn't you say, in the digital age, because we're moving into, I mean, in the Jones case, the data points that GPS, of course, provide are much greater than what is provided by what's called CSLI, cell site location information. But isn't it true that CSLI, as we get more and more smartphones, will get even more precise, precise as putting a GPS tracking device on a car, for example, which was the basis of the Jones case?
This is the second dimension of the case, which is so fascinating. It's not simply a static question of law, when should the constitutional protection against unlawful searches apply, that the court confronts. But it's also the fact that this is an area where government practice is rapidly evolving, where new technologies and new surveillance techniques make likely greater intrusions over time. And that has added to a sense of urgency, I think, certainly among the civil liberties advocates, that the court needs to begin to draw some lines. Otherwise, we will enter a time very quickly, if we're not already there, where the purpose of the Fourth Amendment is largely undercut by the new surveillance techniques. But I do want to stress, and I think it is an important point to make, about the third-party doctrine. It is very important through the judicial lens to answer the question, what is the scope of constitutional protection for personal information? But that is not the entire question. And, for example, if we think about an earlier court case, Smith versus Maryland, where the Supreme Court said that there was protection for the contents of a telephone call, but not for the records associated with the telephone call, or more precisely, the telephone numbers that might have been dialed to make the call, Congress later came back and said, well, that's the view of the court about the privacy protections for telephone numbers dialed, but in the opinion of Congress, there should be protections. And so, in fact, in the mid-1980s, Congress enacted the Electronic Communications Privacy Act in part to reverse, in effect, the judgment of the Supreme Court and to create statutory protections for telephone numbers dialed. So even as significant as the third-party doctrine is in limiting the scope of constitutional protections, it doesn't mean that there aren't other ways in law in which those safeguards are established.
So were you referring then to the 2014 case where the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that police usually need a search warrant to go through a smartphone's contents?
So this is another case. We've talked about the Jones case, which is 2012.
Right.
And that concerns GPS tracking. All the justices, by the way, in Jones agreed that the Fourth Amendment required a warrant. There was disagreement as to the rationale that the warrant was required. Justice Scalia viewed it at the time as simply a physical trespass. Justice Alito said it was a violation of the expectation of privacy, and Justice Sotomayor seemed to feel that, you know, Alito was right and Scalia was right and that more needed to be done. The more recent case, which is significant also now, is Riley versus California, and the question in that case was whether the police needed to obtain a warrant to search the contents of a cell phone that had been obtained after an arrest. And again, this was very much about the technology. There were several preceding cases in which the court had said, well, if it's just a wallet or a pack of cigarettes or something like that, maybe it's okay to do the search without the warrant. But when the court considered just a few years ago how much personal information was on the cell phone and how much personal information could be acquired from the cell phone, they actually reached a different conclusion and said that, in fact, the warrant would be required. And that was the unanimous opinion of the court by Chief Justice Roberts. So the third point, I think, as we're thinking about Carpenter, which is now before the court, we've talked about the third-party doctrine, we've talked about the rapidly evolving technology, but there's a surprising amount of wind in the sails for the argument that constitutional safeguards should be established for locational data because of these two recent and related opinions by the court, where the court seemed to be unanimously in favor of the view that a warrant is necessary for searches involving these new technologies.
Well, unfortunately, the tendency as we rely more and more on smartphones and computers and social media is, particularly amongst the young people, is to voluntarily give up privacy in terms of what they post online, in Facebook, all the extraordinary details about what they do socially, much of which could work against them, you know, an employment situation where the potential employer can look through their social media profiles and find out a lot about perhaps some of their bad habits. So psychologically, it doesn't seem that we seem to be so wedded to these devices, and more devices, of course, tell the government, if you will, more and more about you. For example, this new craze of wearing Fitbits to improve your health, that's also a tracking device. So I guess,
but again, I think it's a little bit unfair, you know, to users of these devices, to consumers, and particularly to young people, to suggest that somehow this indicates they don't care about privacy. In fact, many studies have shown that young people care very much about privacy, and they do many things online to try to protect their privacy. The problem is that the services are set up oftentimes to mislead people about how the personal information is going to be used. Typical users on Facebook, for example, think that they're sharing information with the friends that they have pre-selected. They have very little understanding that that information is also being disclosed through advertising networks to display ads. So the fact that advertising networks get access to the personal data is not a reflection of the user's lack of interest in privacy. It's more a reflection of how the service is designed to conceal the advertising model. And this is true also with many of the other techniques that are being used today to track the activities of users. Much of it is paradoxically actually quite secretive. As users are being told they have less and less privacy, the ways in which information about them is being collected and used becomes more secretive. And it's a bit, of course, like being on the wrong side of a one-way mirror. But when we think about the role of law, when these types of challenges emerge, I think the good news is that laws can help restore a bit of symmetry there so that companies that collect and use data become more transparent about how that information is being gathered and users are given greater control. And that is typically what a good privacy law will do. It will impose greater transparency on the company that's collecting and using the personal data and give individuals more control. So returning to people online today who are disclosing a lot of personal information, oftentimes they do this because they have no awareness of how their data is being transferred to third parties. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to correct that imbalance before we could conclude that they don't care about the loss of privacy.
No, well, I think I'm glad you pulled me over on that, because I recently interviewed Jonathan Taplin, who has a book out about how these big monopolies like Google and Amazon have essentially a model of surveillance capitalism, where they are able to get massive amounts of information on individuals and commodify them.
Well, Jonathan, I mean, that's a very good book, but I will properly credit Shoshana Zuboff with the framing of surveillance capitalism. She's written about that extensively, and I think she's absolutely correct that this is how commercial value is created on many of the platforms. And it poses a real challenge because, of course, markets don't operate as they have in the past. We really don't have a choice about social networks or search engines or increasingly email services, because there's a dominant provider, and that provider will obtain as much personal data as they're able to.
Right, and they are able to commodify it and make profit from it, but the individual doesn't get anything out of it, right? So that's a bit paradoxical. Well, I thank you for joining us, and I guess we'll stay tuned to what the Supreme Court does, because clearly the Fourth Amendment at various levels is under attack. Many people think it's already been shredded, but this is definitely an important...
Well, as I said, in this area, I think there's reason for optimism. We're following the case closely. Epic will likely file an amicus brief in Carpenter, as we did in Jones and Riley, and the court is oftentimes interested in our views, and we're hopeful that if they take a close look here, they will agree that the warrant should be required prior to the location data being obtained.
Well, Mark Rodenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Great. Nice speaking with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Rodenberg, who's the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University and has testified before Congress and has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panels on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD and legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO. And he chairs the American Bar Association's Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. And again, I'm Ian Masters, and this has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.